You are listening to a podcast from Raritan Valley Community College.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Ashley Gefkinetti. I'm Vice President of Leadership and Service of Phi Theta Kappa. And welcome to the final TD Bank Leadership Development Series of the semester. It is thanks to the generous funding of TD Bank that this event is possible, especially for you to be able to enjoy the food and the speakers that come here today. The TD Bank Leadership Development Series is also possible thanks to Alicia Herma Weaver from Career Services, the Student Life Foundation, as well as Student Government Association. This series provides students with participants an invaluable opportunity to improve leadership skills while reconnecting with friends and expanding their professional and personal networks. Our speaker today, Isada Sakoa Aluadare, is a two-time Rutgers alumni and currently serves as the Associate Dean of Student Affairs for the Honors College at Rutgers, New Brunswick. Ms. Sakoa Aluadare has served in various capacities within student and academic affairs, including residence life, Upward Bound, Student Support Services, the Educational Opportunity Fund, and her most recent role as Director of Strategic Planning and Programming for the Office of Student Access and Educational Equity. She is a first-generation immigrant and college student who grew up in New Jersey City and has a family of 10. Her personal experience has shaped her strong communication to social justice and educational equity. The main focus of her presentation today is The Heart of Leadership by Mark Miller. It is my honor and privilege to welcome Isada Sakoa Aluadare. Thank you.
So my voice tends to carry, but I've been told that I need to speak into this mic, I believe because there is a live streaming going on. Thank you all so much for coming out, and thank you so much for having me today. I am honored to be able to come here and talk about my experience. When I was asked to speak, you know, I wanted to make sure that I didn't make this hour painful for you guys. So I thought about the best way to tell my story, and the book that came to mind was The Heart of Leadership that was written by Mark Miller, who happens to be the Vice President for Organizational Effectiveness of Chick-fil-A. And his story is that he literally started out as a cashier, working fries, and then worked his way into the mailroom, and then eventually worked up to the VP role. And so that story of kind of starting from the ground up resonated with me. And the way that he simplified the view of leadership, you know, there's so many books, hundreds of books out there on leadership. Someone is always trying to tell you 12 steps, 10 steps, what you should do, do's and don'ts. And what I liked about his book is that it really focused on simplifying what people look for in their leaders. And my husband was a person who actually gave this book to me as a gift when I came into my first management role at Rutgers, because I was very young and I was nervous. I didn't know what I was going into. Everyone kept talking about politics, the politics, and you know, you're a student, so you don't see the politics of higher education, but there's quite a bit involved, and I wanted to know how to navigate that. And since I've always been someone who's been hungry for wisdom, I started going all around looking for mentors, and he said, you know, I think you're overcomplicating it, and you just need to understand that you've gotten where you are because people see great leadership skills and abilities in you, and you need to trust that, and you kind of need to lead with the heart. So I'm going to tell my story today, but I'm going to tell it in the context of the five key points that Mark Miller uses in this book to talk about all of these character traits that the best leaders possess and what people look for. So I hope that it'll be helpful to you, and hopefully you'll see yourself in some of this, and if you're considering, you know, making a big change or being a part of a great impact in your community, in your society, when you transfer from Raritan Valley, I want you to kind of hold on to the principles, and I will ask you to participate throughout the presentation here and there, so hopefully you'll be willing to do that. So the first principle in Mark Miller's book was hunger for wisdom. Now, I guess I should also tell the story about how he came about this book. There was someone that he was mentoring who was a high performer at his job. He was working in corporate, making good money, but for some reason he could never get into the promotional positions of becoming a leader. And he was a doer. He would always make sure that the projects got done, and he just didn't understand why he wasn't getting considered for promotion. And after being passed up, he asked his supervisor, you know, I noticed that every time there's a special project, you give it to me. But when there's time for a promotion, you pass me up for someone else. Why is that? He said, well, you know, you just don't have these leadership traits that I look for in a leader. You're great at getting things done, but that's not leadership. And that was something that I had to learn as well, because I think I've always been a taskmaster, right? I've always wanted to learn, but I thought that my learning needed to come from books. I'm going to go online. I'm going to get as much information. I didn't think about the fact that hunger for wisdom also means learning from people. And so just to kind of go back a little bit of my story, I grew up with 8 siblings and I was the middle child. And I was the one who always questioned. I wanted to know, why are we having this rule? Why do I have to be in by a certain time? And my dad would be like, you ask way too many questions. Well, I need to know. If I'm going to do something, you need to give me some information. But that inquisitiveness, not really challenging authority, just wanting to know, led me to be very active, not only in my academic life, but in my personal life, to the point where by the time I was 13, I was serving as a tutor, a peer leader, a cheerleader, a basketball player, and I was in a business magnet program. And I kind of look back now and I'm like, oh, how did you get involved in all of those things? It was really just a hunger for wisdom. If there's information out there, I want to find it. I want to figure out the source of where the information is. It's not okay for someone to just give me the information at face value and think that I'm going to take it that way. And I also think that that has driven me into leadership roles and leadership positions at a fairly young age, because when I walk into a situation or just think about, you know, being new on the job, I don't just want to know my job. I want to know the job of the secretary. I want to know what my colleague is doing, not because I'm nosy, but because I want to figure out what role everyone plays on the team so that we can work better as a team. And so going into that situation, realizing that no matter who the person is, whether they are the janitor or the VP of the organization, everyone has something to offer you. Everyone has a tidbit of wisdom that they can impart on you. And so making sure that you're leading with that, that your hunger for wisdom is not just for knowledge, it's not just for things that are going to move your career ahead, but an appreciation of those who are around you. And also keeping in mind that mentors are a good source for wisdom. And every level that you go into, there's someone who's been there before. And sometimes I'll have students and come to my office and they'll ask me questions. And I say, well, you know, have you sought out a mentor? Have you went to go ask anyone? No, I haven't figured out. Why? Why would you take the long way when there's someone else who can tell you about their mistakes, tell you about what went well, possibly connect you with someone who's going to get you to that next level? I personally am not interested in learning lessons the hard way. If I can find someone who's kind of past the road that I'm going on, who has crossed the bridge that I'm trying to cross, I try to connect with them. And really, that mentorship isn't just about you sucking out information, right? It's a mutually respectful relationship. There's something that your mentor gains from mentoring you. It was my mentor who told me to come here today, you know, and it's something that I might not typically do. But because I value the opinion of my mentor, I said, absolutely, because I understand that it's not just about my mentor teaching me things, but me being of help to her. So keep that in mind, that as you go out and seek mentors, you want to find people who are either where you are, or maybe they have a character trait that you admire and you wish to aspire to be like. But find mentors, no matter what your field. So I'm going to ask you guys some questions about mentorship. How many of us have a mentor in our field, in our career, where we're going? And those of us who do, how did you come across this mentor? Thank you. Tell me your name, too, and what class you are. Hi, Veronica. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. And what field is that, if you don't mind? Okay. And she's a business owner, which is awesome. Okay. Great. So you found your mentor at your workplace. Other folks? Awesome. Thank you. Hi, Taylor. Mm-hmm. Yes.
An additional thing. In this organization, I've got 20 years of experience in my field, but I can still learn. So I signed up to get a mentor, but I also signed up to serve.
Exactly. Because you also get from giving to others. Yes. Hi, Spencer. Exactly. Yes. And so, rather you came across your mentor through your workplace, intentionally joined an organization, knew a family member, or the person sought you out, it is always important to have someone to kind of show you the ropes. And, you know, it's a mentoring relationship. So you want to make sure that you're not emulating or putting this person on a pedestal, because they're still a human being as well. And that's one thing that I had to learn from my mentors, is that, yes, my mentors have a wealth of knowledge and experience, but there's only a certain level that they can take me to. Some decisions and some mistakes I'm going to have to make for myself. And sometimes as you develop that mentoring relationship, they start to let you in on some of the things that they're struggling with. And then before you know it, your mentor becomes your colleague, becomes your peer, and becomes a sense of support as you start to move forward. And that's what I've seen in my career. The second bullet that I want to focus on is expecting the best. No one wants to be on a team with a negative Nancy. And if you are a leader, and I hope no one's name in here is Nancy. I apologize. And if you are a leader and you're responsible for leading the team, and you start the conversation off by saying, like, oh, this is a huge task, this is a huge project, I don't know how we're going to do it, but let's do it anyway. People are looking for the leader in the room to be optimistic. They want to know that when they turn to you, you're going to be the calm in the storm. If you're hysterical, if you are freaking out, I'm going to give you a story. So I was working, when I was in Upper Bound, I was a hall director, and I had a boss who was new to the job. And he wasn't necessarily the best person under pressure. So we would have a crisis, and he'd completely panic. And I was a grad, and I'd just kind of be there trying to figure things out. The parents would come to me, get tons of questions. And one day we had a huge situation with parents, and the parents wrote a letter to the president about the situation. And I was asked to go in and kind of talk to the president about, well, what happened here? Why are letters coming to the president? And it was difficult because, you know, you're working with a leader who at that time didn't expect the best from the students, didn't expect the best from his staff and his employee, and didn't think they were capable of the best. So all of his decisions were driven on a negative spin. And what it did is it left the students unhappy, parents were disgruntled, I was stressed out, trying to keep a united front, but also kind of tell them, like, you know, I need you to be a little bit more positive about what we're doing here. But the program really suffered. And, you know, we lost a lot of student involvement because of that. And luckily, he was able to come to the fact that when you're the leader, unfortunately, no one's going to care that much when you have a bad day. They're still expecting you to solve the problems. The saying goes that it's lonely at the top. So, yes, you can see all of the challenges. You have a bird's eye view of what's coming ahead of you. But you cannot allow that to spill over to the people who are following you. So how many of us are on student organizational boards or are leaders on campus, just a show of hands? And does anyone have a story that they can kind of share about a time that, you know, maybe a situation seemed like, someone looks like they might. Maybe a situation seemed like it wasn't going to go so well, but as the leader, you kind of have to take the reins and be optimistic about the outcome and how that worked out for you. I am. I see you.
I wrote a letter. I'm Dee, by the way.
Hi, Dee.
I'm the vice president of media information for student government. But before I've done that, I've always been really involved with the Alliance on campus. And a lot of times, midway through the semesters, our member numbers will drop and we'll get really disheartened because, you know, there was a lot of negativity going on there. And it puts a lot of pressure on you to be that person that has to kind of pull everyone together and refocus onto the positive and the good impacts that you can make on the student body at the same time.
Okay. How did you handle that, though? Like, what did you do?
I
Agreed. Yes.
If I could speak for Dee and elaborate on her story more recently, yesterday morning, she maybe slept in and missed a class. And prior, she had millions of stresses, which we all do at a lot of different times for many different reasons. But she had many, many in the last couple of days. And yesterday, she texted me while missing her class. And I came into the office, and every morning I come in, and she goes, "Morning, Russell, it's going to be a great day. You know why?" And I came in, and I expected not to hear that. And I came in, and we have big bright whiteboards over in the student life area. She took over one of them and wrote, "Why today's going to be a great day." And for 30 minutes, she wrote probably 150 reasons that she has to be thankful and positive today.
Exactly.
And then she expanded on that today and took another bigger board out in the public area and wrote a big message similar and encouraged everyone else to put out the reasons that they have to stay positive and keep going.
Exactly. Thank you. That's awesome. Great leadership skill. See, that's great. And that is what people look for in leaders. They want to know that even when the going gets tough, you're going to continue to move the sales forward. Before I came into this role, and I'm literally 2 weeks into my associate dean role, I was asked to put together a unit of 45 staff members who had never worked together. And we went into the first meeting, and people were so grumpy and disgruntled because all they could see was that this merge of these departments into Student Access and Educational Equity, we're going to take away their autonomy, it's going to water down what we do, and you don't care, you know, you're young, you know nothing about the work that we've kind of put into creating this. And we had to be positive, myself and my supervisor at the time, and just say, you know what, we understand that everyone in the room has a great contribution to bring. Finances were difficult. The personalities were difficult. We have 7 programs with 7 different goals, but we can do this. And no matter how much negativity or hostility we were met with in these meetings, every time we were going through the transition and planning, we just always say, you know what, thank you so much for all you do. We continue to recognize the staff. We continue to highlight when people did something positive to kind of try to drown out some of the negative noises that were always seeming to creep back to the top. And so, you know, and I'm happy to say that a year and a half later, when we looked at our staff team, when we looked at the committee work, when we looked at how far we'd gotten with assessment, it was difficult to believe that those same 45 people a year and a half ago were really negative on the outlook, and now they could actually see, like, wow, this was a positive thing, and thank you guys for doing that. And I didn't even realize until I was leaving that people were recognizing that, you know, I know it's been a really tough situation, but you've done a great job, and we're sure you'll do great later on. And that taught me that even when I had those down days, getting in front of people, giving them a smile, giving them something to look forward to, it really does help inspire others. So always make sure that you as the leader are walking into the room, or you're walking into a new situation, or even if that situation for you is transferring into a bigger school or leaving the state once you leave Raritan Valley, that you're going in there expecting the best. Being aware and seeing that there are challenges ahead of you, but, you know, it's a reason why Super Soul Sunday on Oprah is so popular, why The Secret was so popular, why everyone went and bought the book. And it's optimism. It's contagious. And so either the person who is being negative is going to become so annoyed that they leave, or it's going to have to rub off. But make sure that you're setting the temperature. Yes. Yes.
And it really changed my perspective in terms of personally and professionally. When I find myself complaining or disgruntled, I turn it around to myself and say, "What? You know, how can I solve this? How can I problem solve this?" And mm-hmm. I go to mentors, to people, who can I go to help me solve this?
Yes. Yes. Thank you. That is an excellent segue onto the next point. Accept responsibility. You didn't know that, right? So let's go off of that story. So oftentimes we may have a negative experience, or we're in a negative environment, and we're looking to the people ahead of us or above us to kind of fix that situation. It would have been really easy in your case, again, to complain, to highlight all of the things that have gone wrong. Or how about when you're on a team and there's one team member who will not do their part of the project, and now everyone has to suffer? It's really easy to say, well, Bill, you didn't do your part, and that's why this sucked. And I don't want to work with you ever again, but it wasn't my fault. I did my part. And that's what we call throwing people under the bus, right? But a leader accepts responsibilities not only for themselves and the environment, but is willing to accept responsibility for the people that they are leading. And when I also had a position where I was relatively new and I'd gotten a detail wrong, and what ended up happening was I told all of the students, like, oh yeah, there's some crazy fee. And I told them that by them being a part of our program, that fee was going to be waived. I thought I heard that in conversation, but I was wrong. And now I had 300 students calling the registrar's office saying, well, Ms. Sacco told us that this fee was going to be waived. I went into my office, my supervisor's office, sweating. I'm like, oh my goodness, this is thousands of dollars. These parents are irate. What am I going to do? And I very easily explained to her, like, you know, I made a mistake. And instead of her telling me, like, wow, what a ridiculous mistake that was, she took the problem on like it was her own. And she said, don't worry about it. Nobody's dead. We can fix it. That's what she always used to tell me. She goes, as long as no one's dead, trust me, we can fix it. Don't panic. Just come tell me. Right. And I used to look at her like, well, no, this is a huge issue. And so she made some phone calls, and we were able to figure it out in the end. And at the end, she sat me down. And I was just so impressed by the way that when she approached it, she called and she said, you know what? We made a mistake. We told our parents X, Y, Z. It was a misunderstanding. Can we fix it? As opposed to her saying, my employee who's new didn't know the ropes and made a mistake. Can we fix it? That would have worked just fine, right? But her kind of taking the responsibility for that and not letting it cripple me moving forward, still allowing me to go out there and make other decisions and make other mistakes that I did eventually end up making, made me have more confidence in her as a leader, because I knew she had my back. People want to know that the leader has their back. They want to know that and accepting responsibility, that when you're at the head of a group or a project, that you're going to see it through the end, and it's your job to motivate the people who are working with you, or to really understand, what type of team member do I have? Is this a person where I can set it and forget it, or is this the type of person where I need to follow up with them all the time? And it's up to you to take responsibility in that group environment and really take the driver's seat in making sure that you reach the end goal. The other part in taking responsibility is, I think about when I first went into Rutgers, and Rutgers was so huge. I was just at a meeting this morning. They told us that our student enrollment is up to 66,000 students. And if I thought that it was insane when I went in, this is huge. But one of the things that they tell you early on when you go into Rutgers is that, you know, the professor isn't going to come look for you. If you miss class, you're not going to get an email. You may not even get a warning that, oh, you're on the verge of failing. That's a courtesy. They don't do that. But your next 4 years is your responsibility, was what they told us. You need to know what your requirements are. You need to make sure you're fulfilling them. You need to make sure your term bill is paid on time. And at the end, we give you the diploma. Very different from high school for me, and might be a little different for you guys, depending on where you're interested in going. So the idea that any leadership opportunity that I was going to get, any experience, it was all there, but I had to take the initiative to go out and do that. I had to take the initiative and go out and see someone at Career Services. I needed to take the initiative and join student organizations, go see my faculty members, who were awfully intimidating, because at a Research One school, they have 300 students coming at them at once. What's going to distinguish you? What's going to set you aside? So I think my Rutgers experience also taught me that, you know, I need to take responsibility for my future. And that's something for you guys to think about. No matter which environment you go into, don't expect others to kind of pave the way for you. Be ready to be the go-getter in the room and pave the way for yourself. Responding with courage. So this point also talks about what leaders do when it's time to break out of the comfort zone. When I graduated from grad school, I had the choice of staying at Rutgers and getting a really great position that was going to pay me a great amount, or going to upstate New York. I was telling Alicia about that earlier. And I chose to go to upstate New York because I understood that I needed to get out of my comfort zone. And part of that was I'd stayed in the same university for my undergrad and graduate degree. I felt like everyone knew me, and I really didn't know if they liked me because if I was one of their students, or was it the fact that I really brought something special to the table? So I went up to Syracuse University, even though I really wasn't interested in living there because it was gray from October to May, like literally snowed on graduation day, which was crazy to me. But being able to step out of that made me learn that I had a lot of talents that I was bringing to the table, that no matter which environment that I was in, I could swim, I could survive, because it was an environment where they expected a great deal from their professionals. And I remember someone who at the time was a mentor, and that's something to also keep in mind, is that at some point you may have to move on from the mentor when a mentor can't take you further than they've already gone. So this mentor told me, like, oh, I offered you a position here, you could stay, but you're taking this job here and they're going to pay you less than half of what I'm offering you. That's ridiculous. And I said, well, this is my decision to make. I'm going to make this decision, I'm going to step out, and until today, I'm reaping the benefits of being able to step out in that comfort zone, because it gave me something else to think about, and it reminds me that even when the going gets tough, there's always another option. I love Rutgers. I love working there. I love our students, but I know that there's always another option and that I can survive, and others around me know that she's not afraid to take that step. And also, responding with courage comes when there's time to make difficult decisions. There are times as a leader that I've had to make decisions where we're going to cut this budget. We're going to try to start this new project. And people are saying, you know, it's high risk. Why are you taking these risks? But leaders have to be the ones who are willing to take the risks and understand that everything won't always go as planned. But when the mistakes come, we're going to deal with them and we're going to roll with the punches and move on to the next thing. You can't be so consumed with being perfect, can't be so consumed with getting every step right, because the truth of the matter is that we're imperfect, we're human beings, mistakes are inevitable. So the sooner you accept that, and the sooner you are less concerned about, well, if I make this mistake, what will people say, will they criticize me, the better off you'll be in the long run. And my husband and I are really into real estate, and so we go to all these sessions, and it always comes down to the same thing. We have tons of great ideas, but the only way that people, how you become a Donald Trump or someone who's extremely successful, is taking the risk, doing the things that other people are not willing to do. So you have to be willing to get out of that comfort zone, and you have to be willing to respond with courage when you have the opportunity to stay right where you are or venture out into the unknown. Okay. And then finally, and then after I'll open it up for some questions, is thinking of others first, being unselfish, servant leadership. It's last because it's heart of leadership, but I think thinking of others first should really be the first principle. You can always tell when you're working for someone or the person who is leading you is self-centered or selfish. And what it does is it causes the people around you not to trust in you. They know that, well, when it comes down to it, you're making the best decision for yourself, not what's good for the organization or not what's good for the team. So thinking of others makes me think of what one of my mentors told me once, where he was like, you know, I want you to sit down and envision your life and think of your dream. And okay, at the time I was like 16, and he's like, what do you see? I'm like, oh, I'm in a Ferrari, I have on these red leather gloves, I'm 25, my hair's blowing in the wind. I did not have a Ferrari, I still do not have a Ferrari. That was an unrealistic dream at the time. but what he told me, he's like, that's funny, because your dream, this vision that you have, only involves you. That's not a dream, that's narcissism. Your dream needs to be bigger, right? Your dream needs to be bigger than you. What you're bringing to the table, it needs to be something that you're passionate about that is bigger than how it's impacting your day-to-day. So let's just go in the room. What are some social issues or just anything in general that you're really passionate about that not only impacts you but impacts people around you? Anyone can talk. You need to raise your hand. Fight for equality. In which ways and for which groups? All groups or just in general?
For all groups, but I think personally I'm very passionate about, like,
Mm-hmm. Racial inequality. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it reminds me of a cartoon that I saw that showed equality versus equity. Yeah, I don't know where that was, but I see that other people may have seen that. Mm-hmm. Other issues? So I'm most passionate about orphans and homeless people, right? So for me, my ultimate end goal with education is to be able to go back. As they mentioned in my introduction, I'm a first-generation immigrant. And the country where I came from has been war-torn with civil war for quite some time. And now we have a high rate of orphans and a high rate of widows. And the social services system is not like it is in the United States. No one cares. These orphans are on their own. These women are on their own. And my mother and I were able to start an organization in Democratic Republic of Congo, where I come from, where we contribute to this orphanage and are able to give school supplies and clothing and all of these things. And my ultimate end goal, even in all that I do, is one day I want to go back. I want to open up a school that is a boarding school for orphans, and I want to be able to give them their academic support, their social support, and even in African countries, people don't even believe in mental health. And my background is in social work. So to be able to do that, that drives everything. And there's literally a vision board in my bedroom that's like, no matter what you're going through now, remember that the end goal is to make an impact for all of those people. So it keeps me going. It encourages me to pursue my doctorate because I know what I want to do with it. And that just kind of tells you that if you're thinking about setting a goal for yourself, try to set a vision that is grander than just you. Find something that you are passionate about that once you leave, your legacy can outlive you. But if your legacy is only going to die once you leave the earth, then you haven't even left a mark. So I just want to encourage you guys to think big. And that's where it goes back to the heart of leadership. And the acronym that Mark Miller uses to talk about it is a hunger for wisdom, expecting the best, accepting responsibility, responding with courage, and thinking of others. Thank you. So I want to open it up for questions. I know that this is probably abstract, but even if your questions are not directly related to the presentation, if you just have general questions about my experience or the Rutgers experience, I'm happy to answer them. Okay. Yeah? I call the people in my life that I know are risk takers. I have some friends who always, because I'm not a risk taker, believe it or not. I have some friends who always tell me, Asada, life is all about risks. And I used to tell them, like, that's the worst advice I ever heard. Life is not all about risks. That just sounds like a recipe for disaster. But when I know that there's something that I really need to do, I call the sensible friends who I know are risk takers, who I know are going to encourage me, people who know my strengths. So one of my friends from undergrad is in a doctoral program in Temple, and when the position for this associate dean job came up and I was recommended to apply, I was like, me out of all people? Why me? And she's like, what do you mean? Why not you? And it's for an honors college that doesn't exist yet, so it's high risk, right? And she says, well, this is a great opportunity. If this goes well, this is going to be great for students. It's going to be great for you. It's going to be great for the people that you're working with. She goes, I think you should do it. And, you know, after a while, after getting counsel from those people, I just close my eyes and jump, you know, and to be honest with you, it's still a little nerve-wracking in the beginning, right? So it's not like you close your eyes and jump and you're still okay with it. It takes some time to settle into that. But if you at least have people around you who are going to encourage you to take steps and not call the people who are going to be negative about you breaking out the comfort zone, I think that's important. And I write a lot, so I keep lots of journals. I'm honest about the fact that I'm fearful, and I find, you know, just one person that I can say to, I'm afraid, what do I do? Because I don't believe in pretending, right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, yes, thank you. Thank you for sharing. Yes.
I love the big dreams, because I have big dreams too that are a lot similar to yours, but I also know that there are a lot of times we need to have small things outside of ourselves that keep us motivated. So what are your small things outside of yourself that aren't quite your ending orphanage?
Oh, okay, great. That still keep me motivated. Well, my youngest brother has autism, and so he is now 24, and he actually lives in Branchburg, in a group home in Branchburg. And, you know, at the time that my brother was diagnosed, nobody knew what autism was. We were so young. My mom barely spoke English. We had no help. But to just kind of see over the years how all the attention has been drawn, you know, to autism research, when I meet a student or I see a family with where I can always tell when a child or a person has a disability, I guess it's made me kind of sensitive to developmental disabilities. I always try to make sure to go out of my way to help them. And I always remember being in places when people were kind of watching us with our brother and wishing somebody would just tap and say, I understand, versus giving judgment. So I think small acts of kindness with people that you deal with on a daily basis, with people who come into your, you know, people who are coming into your office. And what I also realize is that when someone is really angry and kind of giving off that angry energy, it's less about me and more about what's going on. So trying to meet people where they are really kind of helps me move forward. And 9 times out of 10, the person will come back and be like, wow, I was having a really rough day and you understood. Or a student who has a developmental disability and was afraid to mention that in another room, and I was able to share my story and encourage them, said, you know, you're the first person who told me don't quit. You're the first person who told me that I could do this. And that, the work that I do, kind of keeps me going until I get to that big vision, if that makes any sense. Yes.
So as leaders, should we prepare for the worst, expecting the best, or should we remove the prepare for the worst, because sometimes preparing for the worst brings that negative mentality or dawning upon.
Well, I think what is definition of best? Is best without flaw? Right? No. I'll tell you that right now, especially when you're working with people. So expecting the best, for me, I think that definition has changed over time. Because for me, the best always meant that this event went exactly as planned. People showed up. People talked. This happened. Check, check, check. It went well. Great. But things don't always work out that way. And when something would go wrong, or even with my own personal life and plans, I'd be really disheveled by that. And so what expect the best means, in my opinion, is yes, I'm going to have a plan B and C, because you need to have that. You need to have some type of contingency plan. But I tried to make the best kind of one goal of the event, right? So, or one goal of whatever it is that I'm doing. So if the end goal is to make sure that this student gets this resource, no matter how long or what, how winding the road is, that takes me to get to that end goal, the best is making sure we reach the goal, not that everything goes exactly how I planned it. So does that kind of answer your question?
Yeah.
No? Sorry.
Mm-hmm. Sort of branching off the expecting the best thing, you talk about being a leader, it's kind of lonely at the top. Mm-hmm. How do you compartmentalize personally if you're having like a bad day going into it, and not bringing that aspect to your team?
Okay. I always come like a few minutes early, close the door, and say, I just need 10 minutes. And I do affirmations. I do. Like, today's going to be a good day. I'm going to keep a positive mind. I'm going to keep a positive attitude about this. And I have bad, like, personal days, bad personal issues that are coming. But you don't want to rub that. You don't want to rub it off on the people who are around you. So even if it's just taking a moment, it's excusing yourself. Or if you're really being honest and saying, I need to take a small break. I won't be in today because I need to gather my bearings. Because the impact of you being a leader and kind of spilling that negativity through your staff, like, once you're over it, and I say staff because, you know, that's who I work with. Once you're over it, they're not over it. They always remember as the leader, because you're living this life in a fishbowl, the one day you caught an attitude with them. Even if you apologize, they really don't get over it. So take the time that you need to get yourself in the right frame of mind. And if you really can't, I'm hoping that there's someone who's either leading you or a supervisor or someone else that you can go to and say, I'm really struggling with this. Can you help me process? No, ask for help. Any other questions? Well, thank you. Yes. Yes. None? Mm-hmm.
To sort of expand off that idea, being student leaders, a couple of us here, standing out in you know, a smaller pond is an easier thing.
Mm-hmm.
Something that's like 66,000 students.
Mm-hmm.
How do you stand out in that transitionary process?
Right. I think one of the things that we have at Rutgers that's really cool is like the first 2 days of the school year will be a huge involvement here. Hundreds of student organizations, and they're out there on the lawn. The mistake that I've seen a lot of our students make, and I've had a chance to work kind of like with this transfer student population at Rutgers, is they come in and they want to hit the ground running. But you need to get to know the landscape first. So my thoughts are, yes, it's a big pond, but there are ways to create niches of communities where you can kind of shine and excel. But if you spread yourself out too thin, you'll never get to that point because you're inundated by having to take the bus to 5 different campuses to get to your classes. And now you've spread yourself so thin that you just have these organizations that you're putting on your resume, but you have nothing to show for it. Versus thinking of one interest or two interests that you have now or two talents that you have now that you're really great at, finding an organization at Rutgers or creating your own organization at Rutgers if you find, or somewhere that is similar to the size of Rutgers, if you find that your interests aren't being met, and developing that and making yourself a pioneer in that way. You know, so my thought would be to find a way to make a large space feel a little bit smaller. And student organizations and getting involved with co-curricular activities are a really great way to do that. But it's important to always keep the balance in mind. I always would tell my transfer students, one or two things the first year. Don't spread yourself too thin because it is an adjustment. Mm-hmm. With Rutgers? No. Well, that's true, because the School of Engineering is there, and School of Engineering are one of those unique places where all of their students can go into their 2 or 3 buildings and take their classes. But if you're coming in, and maybe you will have all of your general education requirements met, but if you have to take another part of the core, it's likely that you're going to have to go across the river to do that. So, yeah, it is much easier for an engineering or a STEM student to kind of locate themselves on those campuses.
No, I just think, like, I know I've seen, like, someone like Cook Douglas, mm-hmm. Was like linked to the bus.
Well, people take the Rex B now. they've done a much better job with the bus system, to be honest.
I know. I've seen it. It's part of the new subway in
Washington. Okay. Yeah, now that's accurate. It is. And what I used to do was I'll wait for the bus door and follow the bus door and jump on. It really is like the New York subway getting on. Because... Oh no, it's not quite like that. I mean, right? There's no graffiti. Mm-hmm. Well, no, I do want to be honest and say that the Department of Transportation, we just went through a capital planning process where students were asked to take a survey of where they go on campus and how far they have to go, because they understand that with scheduling, students are having a hard time getting in between their classes. So it's something we're addressing, and I'm pretty sure that now there is a bus that links directly from Cook Douglas to Livingston and College Ave and Bush. Mm-hmm. Oh, well, you don't have to go on Route 1. That's a great thing. I've been here for quite some time. I don't think you have to do that, but I understand it could be a challenge, but we've done a better job. I initially went to Rutgers thinking that I would go to law school, and my counselor at the time was like, oh, Asada, there's this peer mentor position. I think you should go for it. I'm like, what? I'm so not interested in hearing people's problems. Why would you think that I should be a peer mentor? He's like, no, I think you have leadership capabilities. I'm like, what does that mean? And then I'm like, well, but why a peer mentor? He said, you know, just do it. I did it for one summer, and that was it. I became an RA. I continue to do it. And up until now, I've done so many summer programs. I don't know what my life feels like without doing that. But when I finally got to take a constitutional law class, because there's no pre-law at Rutgers, so I had to take constitutional law in my third year, and it was so boring. And I had to read all of these cases. Now I'm more willing to read those cases. But at the time, I could not trace my end goal. And it probably had something to do with not having a clear vision. I just decided when I was 8 years old that I was going to be a lawyer and never thought twice about it until it came time to take that class. And that's why another reason why it's so important to get experiences or talk to people who are in the field that you're interested in. Because every lawyer I talked to at the time, I guess it just wasn't meant to be, said, no, don't do this. It's terrible. I'm like, well, why would I become a lawyer if the alums who are lawyers are telling me, don't become a lawyer, I hate it? But, you know, my counselor said, well, you seem to really enjoy this, so why don't you think about taking a position with us after you graduate? And I took a position and went into the master's program, and the rest is history. But I never expected that I would stay in student affairs for as long as I have. So this goes to show you. You know, if you have a good mentor, they may see things in you that you don't know are there. Oh, that's a good question. Assistant. Yeah, resident assistant. Well, we like to call it the residence hall, not the dorm. But yes, they do. Yes, they support the students who live in the residence halls. Okay. Mm-hmm. No, and in fact, housing isn't guaranteed for transfers when they come in. Don't want to. Yeah, it's not required.
Well, let's get a round of applause for our speaker.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. A little something for you.
Oh, thank you so much.
So we really wanted to show that we appreciated you coming out today.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. Thank you all for having me, and thank you for being such an attentive audience.
For those of you who don't know who I am, my name is Conrad Colon, and I'm the Executive Vice President of Raritan Valley Student Government Association. I want to thank you all for coming out to this Leadership Series event, and I look forward to seeing most of you next semester with our Spring Leadership Series. The first event of that series will be on February 26th. We have some great speakers throughout the semester. The dates are on the 26th of February, March 26th, April 16th and April 30th. We're proud to announce that former U.S. Ambassador Se-Chan Siv is actually coming to speak and close out our series in the spring, so we hope to see you all there. In addition, some of the programs highlighted in the spring include our Women's Panel for Women's History Month in March, along with leadership development expert Carolyn Coughlin. So, with that being said, thank you so much for coming to our event, and we appreciate your time. We also look forward to seeing our student leaders out there at Leadership Day on January 9th. We hope to see you there.